Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In the late Enlightenment, a new imperative began to inform theories of interpretation, the idea that all literary texts should be read in the same way that we read the Bible. However, this assumption concealed a problem. There's no coherent we who read the Bible in the same way. In Secularism and Hermeneutics, Yael Almog shows that several prominent thinkers of the era constituted readers as an imaginary we around which they could form their theories and practices of interpretation. She argues that this conception of interpreters as a universal community established biblical readers as a coherent collective. In the first part of the book, Almog focuses on the 1760s through the 1780s and examines these writers' works on biblical Hebrew and their reliance on the conception of the Old Testament as a cultural rather than religious asset. She reveals how the detachment of textual hermeneutics from confessional affiliation was stimulated by debates on the integration of Jews in Enlightenment Germany. In order for the political community to cohere, certain religious practices were restricted to the private sphere, while textual interpretation, which previously belonged to religious contexts, became the foundation of the public sphere. As interpretive practices were secularized and taken to be universal, they were meant to overcome religious difference. Turning to literature in the early 19th century in the second part of the book, Almog demonstrates the ways in which new literary genres of realism and lyric poetry disrupted these interpretive reading practices. Literary techniques such as irony and intertextuality disturbed the notion of a stable, universal reader's position and highlighted interpretation as grounded in religious belonging. It's a fascinating big-picture excavation of some of our most fundamental yet unexamined assumptions still informing us today as readers and writers. Yael Almog is an assistant professor of German studies at Durham University. Her research focuses on the interdependence of literary theory, literary production, and theology. More specifically, she looks at secularism, Jewish-Christian encounters, the Jewish-German tradition, and Hebrew literature. She joins me today to talk about her first monograph, Secularism and Hermeneutics. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Secularism. My name's Carolyn Evans, and I'm joined today by Professor Yael Almog to talk about her new book, Secularism and Hermeneutics. Yael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start by asking you a little bit about yourself and how you came to work in your field.
Well, I have always been very interested in literature and literary theory, and I'm trained as a German studies specialist, but actually I first studied comparative literature for my bachelor's and my master's, and I'd say that my specialty really shifted with my migration between different countries. I mean, I'm originally from Israel, but I studied in the United States. This book is, you can say, somewhat based on my PhD thesis after which I completed in California. So this is just to say that I think that my discipline kind of shifted in the sense that I think that different countries have different definitions of what a discipline may entail. And this is why when I moved after my PhD, I moved to Germany and I held several research positions that were in very different fields in history and in theology. And now I actually came back to return to German studies. I mean, I just began a position as an assistant professor at Durham in the UK.
Fantastic. So that's really interesting. So what perspectives do you think the German context brought specifically to this book?
Well, the book came out in an intellectual history series, which I think is great that historians would be interested in my work. I did not necessarily expect that when I completed a PhD in German studies in literature, and I think that this. The fact that I took a position in intellectual history, a postdoc, and then in theology helped me situate my arguments in different contexts.
Okay. I want to start with a context, in fact, because I think before we get into the real meat of the book, just to consider the kind of you begin in the 1700s with the German Enlightenment and their perspectives on reading. But prior to that, I think today even the most unsophisticated writers would instinctively know or consider the fact that authors write for a particular readership in mind. Also, the notion that the Bible must be interpreted in some manner in order to make it personally meaningful seems fairly obvious to us today, I think, for many readers. And so that's why I think books like yours are so exciting, because you're showing us how these fundamental things we take for granted, such as how we read, are actually not obvious or eternal. So maybe start by explaining how the Bible and reading generally was approached prior to the developments you outlined in your book.
Well, I rely in the book on some contemporary trends in the research of secularism and in the research of the Enlightenment. And I would mention perhaps two thinkers that my work relies on who talk about the Bible and the transformation in the status of the Bible. One of them is Saba Mahmoud, who is a part of, you know, the Talal Assad school, we can say, of secularism critique. And people like Mahmoud and Assad have been talking about the Bible as about secularism as an epistemological change, you can say, that namely secularism is a concept that penetrates a certain community, a certain tradition, and really has an immense effect on people's sensibility, on the way people conceive the world. And so those are sets of ideas that I've been really influenced by. Now, the other influence that that led to this book is people working in intellectual history. And I'd mention Jonathan Sheehan, who wrote a book titled The Enlightenment Bible. And there, Sheehan established that the late 18th century produced a new artifact. The Bible became a new artifact. And he really showed that in that period, in the late Enlightenment, let's say, there has been a huge wave of biblical translations. And showing this this wave helped him establish that the Bible became an object that people can identify with. There's been a process of personalization, if you will, of the Bible. And he showed that different readers learned how they can use the Bible for their own agenda. People approach the Bible from within their own agenda. Now, this is where I'm coming from when I started to write this book, because the question that concerned me was the Enlightenment Bible must have been such an influential phenomenon that it must have had an effect on other fields, on other human practices, if you will. And the one that I wanted to focus on is literary theory, literary interpretation. And the main question that I asked is, how does the transformation of the Bible into this personal object influenced literary theory? I would say perhaps that the influence of Saba Mahmoud, of Talal Asad, here is that the question of sensibility, of it's kind of, I have to say, I think that combining those two schools of thought, it's probably the biggest challenge that I encountered writing this book, because those are two very different approaches to this, the question of secularism. And I hope I managed to do that to some extent.
Okay. Well, let's get to Johann Gottfried Herder. You begin with him, and he began in the late German Enlightenment to argue for a new way of understanding the Bible, as you were talking about, especially the mythology-like tales of the book of Genesis. So essentially, he felt that readers' approach to these ancient writings should be, or should follow from an attempt to understand them as cultural artifacts produced by specific historical contexts. Haman, on the other hand, viewed God as a literal author, such that any textual gaps and inconsistencies in the Bible had to be filled in through one's creativity and faith. So if you could perhaps explain further the differences in these approaches and the benefits and drawbacks that each offer.
Yes, it's a complicated question.
Quickly explain. No, I'm just kidding.
I think I would like to take a step back and kind of say a word about why I begin with two chapters that focus on Johann Gottfried Herder. Maybe some of the listeners are not familiar with him. The premise of my book is that we today take the interpretation of literature to be neutral to faith. But in fact, literary interpretation has a certain religious history. This is, I think, by saying this sentence, I think one can already perhaps see the influence of the Talal Asad school of secularism critic, that I want to reflect on the religious history that gave rise to our idea of literary interpretation. And so literary interpretation, this is my premise, it has certain assumptions that work better with some religious traditions than with others. Now, to return to Johann Gottfried Herder, this really came, the interest in Herder came from this question of the personal Bible, of having a Bible to which every reader could relate, every reader could interpret the Bible. So some, that might sound actually like the influence of Martin Luther, right? Like that Martin Luther, and you asked me to kind of go even beyond the 18th century in your previous question. Martin Luther, with his translation of the Bible into German, of course, has been taken to revolutionize the reading and the interpretation of the Bible, together with phenomena such as print and literacy. The Luther translation enabled people to read the Bible and interpret it. And now the reason why I don't start with Luther, but with Herder, is that I think that Luther was not interested in the notion of reason as such, in the Vernunft, if you will, in the German term. And this is why I'm starting my book with two Herder capitals, chapters, I'm sorry, that was a German word, two chapters on Herder, and a comparison, indeed, between Herder and his good friend, Haman. Johann Gottfried Herder, he's interesting to me because he's someone who wrote thousands of pages on the Hebrew Bible. And what I try to show in the first two chapters is that it's really in those biblical commentaries that he came up with terminology that then became constitutive to modern literary theory. And to answer now your question more directly about the differences between Herder and Hamann, Frederick Beiser, a very important scholar of German idealism, compared the two and said that, in a nutshell, Herder secularized some of Hamann ideas. I take both Hamann and Herder to be very important to a new approach to the Hebrew Bible. And this approach is really changing the way Protestant theologians during the late 18th century conceive the role of biblical reading. Because I would say that previously, the focus on reading the Bible was the results, the end result, if you will. The question is, what is the divine imperative that we apprehend by reading the Bible? And this is an approach that took the Bible to be the product of divine revelation. Now, Herder and Hamann really insist that the Bible is a wonderful and supreme artifact, but not because it's divine. Rather, the Bible is fantastic because it's a human. It's a human artifact. This is, of course, was very, very provocative. The Hebrew Bible specifically was very conducive for those thinkers' attempts to think about human reason. When you compare the Old Testament and the New Testament, you can see that the Old Testament is a difficult text. It's fragmented. It has been circulated for thousands and thousands of years. It's hard to understand. Even if you read Hebrew, it's hard to understand. Some words are only used a few times or once, and we don't know what they mean. And when you think about it, theoreticians during that time that are starting to get interested in questions about, you know, in what reason is, what's the human apparatus of understanding the world. This made the Old Testament, in fact, the difficulty to read it, made it a very suitable object for their inquiries. Now, I think this is a very important moment in history, because all of a sudden, the Bible becomes very important, not because it's perfect, exactly the opposite, because it's imperfect. And the main difference that I would describe between Herder and Hamann on that regard is that Herder claims that this process of reading, where each reader engages with the Bible on his or her terms and employs his or her understanding, you know, I would say even reason when reading the Bible, this is really a process that can yield a sort of objective truth, a better understanding of how the Bible was written, of what the Bible meant. Herder, he's well known, I'd say, in the field of history and historiography, because he developed theories about contextualization of cultural artifacts in the context of the period and the culture that produced them. And this is really something that he develops in his readings of the Hebrew Bible.
Okay, interesting. Continuing in this strain of putting it in the context of literary theory, you also draw a connection between Hamann's approach and Walter Benjamin's philosophies of language. So could you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a very ambitious part of the first chapter of the book. Well, Walter Benjamin is a prominent philosopher who has famously commented on many different periods in history, such as the Baroque, antiquity, and it almost seems peculiar that he hasn't referred to the Enlightenment, in fact. And I argue at the end of my first chapter that he actually did. There is an essay that he wrote in 1960 on language as such and on the language of men. I came across an article of a very prominent scholar of German literature, Stefan Moses, who writes about this essay. And Moses argues that at the center of Benjamin's essay is those language theories in the late Enlightenment that were very occupied with the Genesis stories. So Stephen Moses argues that at the center of Benjamin's essay are theories from the late Enlightenment, theories exactly by Herder and Hamann, that argue that the idea that men could use language already immediately after he was created in the, so this is again the Genesis stories, those are really, this notion of the human use of the Hebrew language can teach us about language per se. So, I mean, what I find very interesting with Walter Benjamin is, in a sense, I think his reading of Herder and Hamann is very close to my own reading, in the sense that when people think about the Enlightenment, Enlightenment positivism, if you will, namely our belief that we can use language in a productive way to mark the objects around us, people tend to think this is a secular belief. And what Benjamin is claiming in a nutshell is that this Enlightenment positivism is in fact intertwined with theology.
Going back to, are you talking about the Tower of Babel story in Genesis?
Yeah, yes, it's a part of, this is certainly something that I discuss in this first chapter in the book.
Okay, and so he's making the claim that therefore what people take as Enlightenment notions about the function of language actually stems from much older ideas that can be found traced in the Bible. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I mean, I'd say briefly put what Benjamin, I think, is perceptive of is that the relationship of Enlightenment language philosophy, the idea that we humans have the ability to use language in a productive way to mark the objects in our surroundings, to communicate our the impressions of our senses. This is an Enlightenment legacy indeed, and this legacy actually builds on Enlightenment theology and on theological views that relate already to the biblical myth of the creation of man.
Okay. All right. In chapter two, you talk about how Herder was joined by other eminent figures of the period, such as Johann Wolfgang Goethe, in viewing the Bible as a sublime aesthetic artifact equally available to all readers, Christians and Jews alike. So again, this has a lot to do with language. And you write that in a time that felt some animosity towards Jews, theologians made the distinction between the ancient Hebrew language of the Old Testament, which they revered, and the Jewish people in their midst. So tell us more about that. How does that work?
Yeah, first of all, I wanted to say in that second chapter, I'm not claiming that someone like Goethe promoted political rights for Jews, equal rights, or something like that. Actually, the way I use this phrase is that the Bible was available, became available to all readers alike, exactly because of its unreachability, the inability to reach it. And this is an important point. What I'm claiming in chapter two is that someone like Goethe idealized the Bible, that aesthetic approaches to the Bible made it into this supreme spiritual artifact that, yes, nobody can actually reach. And if nobody can reach it, if nobody can fully understand it, then it doesn't matter if you're Christian or Jewish.
Okay, so equally unavailable almost.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's a paradox indeed. It's a paradox.
Okay. So you also write that this new way of understanding the Bible as a sublime aesthetic artifact, and I'll quote you here, invented, shaped, and negotiated new arguments about aesthetics. So help us to understand what that means.
Yeah, so first of all, this notion of availability that relies on the Bible being unavailable, I mean, what I want to point out really with this idealization of the Bible is that the materiality of the Bible was forgotten. The Bible is written in Hebrew, in Greek, and a little bit of Aramaic. Not everybody can understand it. But in my view, the Bible as an artifact of the late Enlightenment is an idealized object, a supreme object that is beyond understanding, if you will. And the core of the argument in the chapter, and this is really the sentence that you rightly pointed out, is that while creating this ideal object, people were practicing, were developing literary interpretation. So I will rephrase that. Ever since the 18th century, scholars have recognized that there was a trend in the late Enlightenment, which is namely approaching the Bible with terms that were taken from aesthetic theory. So there were eminent theologians such as Robert Loth, such as Herder, and they started in the late 18th century, they started to talk about biblical poetry using terms like verse, like alliteration, like sound, terms that had previously been used to talk about poetry in general. And what I'm claiming really is that it's something else, okay? It's not just recognizing that the Bible became an aesthetic artifact. I'm claiming that those aesthetic theories were not developed before those people approached the Bible. I hope that the difference is clear, that it's not merely taking your theory about aesthetics and about how people should read literary texts and then applying them to the Bible. What I claim is that those people said perhaps that they said that they're going to apply aesthetics to the Bible, but actually with this gesture, they came up with totally new ideas about aesthetics, about readership.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Okay. Yeah, I think I do understand the distinction you're making there. Interesting. Okay. Moving on to chapter 3, you examine more closely the tension between ideas about the Bible as being universally relevant and valuable to all people in all contexts, and about it being specifically a pillar of traditional Judaism. So you look in particular at the way Moses Mendelssohn attempted to bridge these potentially contradictory views. So I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit more. You use the term situated universalism. So I wanted to just get you to explain what you mean by those things.
Yeah, that's also quite a complicated theme that I'm trying to develop. So in a nutshell, my book locates two simultaneous phenomena that are happening in the late Enlightenment. One I've already talked about, the development of hermeneutics, namely of literary interpretation, that is built on a new approach to the Bible. And the second phenomenon, and this is when Mendelssohn comes up, is the really revolutionary notion of Jewish emancipation. The idea that Jews should be treated as equal citizens, the Jews might be entitled of such rights as religious freedom. And what's interesting to me is the disparity between those two phenomena. Because when you look at hermeneutics has, you could say, a liberating potential. When Herder and Haman open up the Bible as an object that is first and foremost a human object, then we no longer need someone like the priest or another religious leader to explain us the Bible. And there is a sense of a universal community of readers. And now, where is then the disparity between this and Jews wanting to get political rights? I talk about it while bringing a letter that Moses Mendelssohn writes to Johann Gottfried Herder. It's a really fascinating letter from June 1780. And in this letter, Mendelssohn is writing Herder, "You own the gift of putting yourself in the place and mindset of your fellow man in order to judge him." And this is really, Mendelssohn really manages to capture Herder's hermeneutics, because Herder is all about understanding the culture that produced the text. And so this is an approach that Herder develops in his readings of the Hebrew Bible. But this is an approach that is really constitutive to literary reading and to an historical understanding of foreign cultures. So what Mendelssohn is asking in his letter is, perhaps you also have some knowledge of rabbinic Hebrew. Perhaps Herder, who knows Hebrew quite well, as Mendelssohn is recognizing, perhaps Herder could also even give some credit, if you will, to traditional Jewish understanding of the Bible. Now, this is really where the disparity lies, because Herder develops his theory of hermeneutics from the notion that, out of the notion that the Bible has been corrupted. Okay, we need to have this understanding of the ancients who produced this text, because Jews in the Middle Ages, throughout history, Jews have corrupted the text. The text has been lost. That's why we have to bridge the gap between us modern Germans, let's say, in the late Enlightenment, and the ancient Hebrew authors. So this is why I start the Mendelssohn chapter with this letter.
Okay. So Mendelssohn also brought his ability to bridge contradictory views into his writings on government as well. You also talk about his book Jerusalem, in which he argues both for the separation of church and state, but also upholds the governance of ancient Jerusalem as an ideal example, even though, according to the Bible, Jerusalem was ruled by a theocracy headed by God. So how does he square this circle?
Well, he really doesn't. He really doesn't. I mean, I don't think that he manages to reconcile, those problems that, namely, on the one hand, Jerusalem is, of course, advertising the idea of separation of church and state. It's a seminal text for this idea. And on the other hand, as you said, Jerusalem contains this almost mythical portrayal of the beginning of, you know, of the Jewish state, where governance was basically perfect. God ruled the world. And so how is that separation of church and state, of course? So in the book, I am not trying to reconcile this. Quite the contrary. I'm not trying to resolve those contradictions in Mendelssohn. My attempt is different. I try to show that this contradiction of seeing Jews as singular people and their views as equal citizens, it resonates with hermeneutics, with questions occurring in hermeneutic during this period, that namely, this is exactly, again, the letter to Herder. Then on the one hand, I think that Mendelssohn recognizes the great potential of hermeneutics as this new, very exciting way to understand humans as belonging to this universal community, as equal members of this community who have abilities, you know, who have reason. He recognizes the potential, and at the same time, I think that Mendelssohn, as a religious Jew, continues to insist on the singularity of Jews as readers of the Bible.
Okay, so he's saying on the one hand that viewing literature from an interpretive perspective shows us that all people basically have the same kind of ability to approach a text. And yet, Jewish people and Jewish readers are still different in some way?
Yes, indeed. And this is a contradiction. It's a problem in Mendelssohn that, in my opinion, cannot be resolved. That, in my opinion, he does not resolve it.
I mean,
scholars have certainly recognized the disparity in Jerusalem between the theocracy, this mythical image of the ancient state of Israel, and the advocating of suppression of church and state. People have definitely noticed that disparity. And what my contribution is not to try to resolve it, but to say that the same disparity exists in Mendelssohn's views on hermeneutics. And this is, again, the tension between looking at Jews as singular people, as, you know, the chosen people, and wanting them to be equal citizens. I mean, and one thing that I noticed that scholars don't talk about that much is really how strange it is that Mendelssohn, who likes aesthetics very much, I mean, Mendelssohn's writings on aesthetics kind of introduced him to the German Republic of Letters. This is how he kind of managed to become a prominent thinker. He has his early writings on aesthetics that very much follow Kantian ideas of aesthetic. And so we have that in his oeuvre. And at the same time, when you read a book like Jerusalem, Mendelssohn really complains about the script, about how in modernity everybody is obsessed with reading. And he talks about the dangers of reading. So I ask myself, indeed, how does that work together? If you like aesthetics, so how can you how can you find reading to be such a dangerous practice?
Wow. That's, yeah. What an interesting contradiction. I love the fact I research literature as well in my scholarly life. And I just, I love the fact that some of these biggest questions about being human come back to literature, how we read, aesthetic theory. That just thrills me, I guess. But because of my own particular inclinations.
Yeah, I'm glad to resonate with you. I mean, Mendelssohn is not often taken on as a literary scholar, and I actually think he has really interesting things to say to us about reading.
Yeah, fascinating. And the fact that, do you think like he couldn't see the contradiction in his own work?
I think he had problems. I mean, I think that there is a big difference between someone like Herder and someone like Mendelssohn, or if you will, someone like Mendelssohn or someone like Immanuel Kant. And the difference is that, you know, Immanuel Kant, nobody twists his arm to say, well, that's not quite right. I mean, of course, every thinker at that time had restrictions. I mean, the church, etc. But Mendelssohn had it really bad. Like, Mendelssohn is an Orthodox Jew, growing up, you know, learning traditional sources. And all of a sudden, he finds himself as a very prominent figure in the German Republic of Letters. And so what I'm saying is that he was involved in polemics where he was a part of that community of leading intellectuals and leading philosophers, and at the same time he had an agenda to propagate that really nobody else had in his circle, and that namely the traditional view of the religious community, Jews as a religious community that is insular, that is somewhat isolated, where Jews are the chosen people, and they have been circulated the Bible, of course, without corrupting it. And those views are very, very, very different than the views of his of his interlocutors.
Well, let's move on now to the 19th century, which was more interested in Greek and the New Testament than it was in Hebrew and the Old Testament. So can you tell us a little bit more about this shift in interest?
Yeah. So the fourth chapter of my book focuses on Schleiermacher. And for Schleiermacher, the model object of hermeneutics is the New Testament, no longer the Old Testament. And then you get the idea that Hebrew is a corrupted language, and that's why we should not focus on it that much. I mean, of course, theologians in Germany continue till today to read Hebrew. But for Schleiermacher, as he develops his theory of hermeneutics, he focuses on the New Testament and specifically on the historical moment where Christ brought about a transformation to the world. So whereas for someone like Herder, the target for hermeneutics is the origins of civilization, for someone like Schleiermacher, what he tries to trace is a moment, a shift in civilization.
Okay. So in this chapter two, in particular, you look at Heinrich Heine's novel, The Rabbi of Bacharach, because its portrayals of liturgical readings show how interpretation is influenced by religious belonging and traditionalist training. So you explain that this undercuts the notions about religious neutrality in interpretation that were prevalent at the time. So please tell us about this.
Yeah, that's perhaps an ambitious aspect of my book, is that I don't only describe how hermeneutics became this modern, religiously neutral practice, but I actually claim that literature challenges this religious neutrality. So I've already said that in my opinion, hermeneutics has a religious history. And there is a strand that is still very important in literature, in literary scholarship, which is literary hermeneutics. The idea that we can read text and penetrate the meanings that the author had in mind. And what I argue with regard to Heine is that Heine really reminds us that readers, including modern readers, are a part of religious communities, and that this affiliation, this belonging to a religious community, totally affects the way they read texts. So for thousands of years, that's the way I see it. For thousands of years, hermeneutics was a term and a practice that was understood in the context of insular religious communities, of those traditions. And in the Late Enlightenment, there is a transformation of that to a large degree, the affiliation with religious communities has changed. That all of a sudden, one is not no longer just a Jew and a Christian. All of a sudden, one is also a part of humankind, of the Menschengeschlecht. And I think that Heine does a very good job in reminding us that religious affiliations continue to inform the way we read texts.
Okay. So chapter five continues with the 19th century, when literary texts respond to the feeling that the Bible is no longer understood as a product of divine revelation. And instead, it represents an ancient stagnant mode of thinking. So please tell us more about this.
Yes, in chapter five, I turn to later stages of German philosophy, and namely, I look at Hegel, who represents in his The Spirit of Christianity and Its Faith, the idea that Jews are inferior readers, in that they can't transcend the literal meaning of the Bible. Now, so for someone like Hegel, this fault has to do with the fact that Jews insist in his mind on primitive laws, the main one being the eye for an eye principle. I hope this answers your question.
Yeah, so So that that characterization of the way Jews read influences in general the perspective on how the Bible should be understood for Christians more broadly. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, it's a really ancient accusation, right? That, I mean, goes way beyond the late Enlightenment. That Christians have accused Jews that they cannot transcend. They cannot transcend the written word and understand that the Old Testament is in fact important in that it is a configuration of the New Testament, right? So this is something that we see way before Hegel. The reason why I bring Hegel is that I believe that this theological view is at the center of his philosophy. And so, as I said before, I was drawn to German idealism because those thinkers came up with very general theories of what human beings are, the way humans understand the world. And I want to point out that in those theories, their notion of biblical readership played an important role.
Okay. To elaborate on how literature may take issue with the modern transformation of the Bible, you look at the 1842 crime novella, The Jew's Beach. And that's the tree rather than the place with sand.
Right, right.
So what
yeah, Jews don't hang out so much at the beach. No, I'm joking.
So what can we learn from this piece of literature?
Yeah, Annette von Droste-Hülshoff's novel is very prominent in the history of German literature. And this is because it's taken as the proponent of Krimi literature, of crime literature. Germans just love crime literature. Actually, everything that has to do with crime, like TV shows. And this novella is very interesting. This is also a part of my attempt to argue that, you know, secularism is not a successful and complete endeavor, right? Like, I mean, and I think that literature continues to remind us of that, of the fact that there are still disparities between religious communities, and those disparities hinder us from participating in the same way in this modern community of readers. And the text specifically, you know, to go into that novella. So at the center of the novella is a crime investigation of the murder of a Jew called Aaron. And it's a very unsuccessful, wow, now a spoiler. nobody really actually knows who killed the guy. Even at the end of the novella, it remains unclear. Now, in the middle of the novella, all of a sudden, you get a Hebrew sentence and without a translation into German. And this is very disturbing. For someone who doesn't read Hebrew. So I talked before about how the materiality of the Bible has been forgotten and how this forgetfulness was the basis of the idealization of the Bible. So what I'm claiming is that when someone like Heine or when someone like Droste Hülshoff reminds us of the materiality of the Bible, then in fact they destabilize literary interpretation. It's interesting perhaps to mention that a translation of this sentence from the novella appears in the very ending, in the very last line of the novella, and then we find out that the sentence means something along the lines of indeed eye for an eye, the Italian principle, the eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. I mean, not quite in those words, but this is basically the meaning of the sentence. And this is, I think, very disturbing to the German reader because not only because of, you know, of course it's scary, the Jew has been murdered and the Jews are going to take revenge. This is a part of it, but I think more so because it reminds us of the religious history of interpretation.
Interesting. Well, in your final chapter, you write that hermeneutics functions in a sense as a replacement for confessional religions and the social functions they provide through interpretation, communal reading, and gathering around texts. So I think this is a really lovely idea, and I thought it might be a good way to open to some concluding thoughts.
Yeah, well, to be frank, those are really just my general feeling that hermeneutics is still a very, very successful practice. I mean, today we like thinking about, after postmodernism, of course, that hermeneutics is no longer really that prominent, but I actually think it really is. And I think that the tradition of literary hermeneutics is what we learn and teach at schools, at universities, how to read a poem, how to interpret a poem and kind of penetrate the hidden meanings of a poem and unearth those meanings. And I think that really today at universities, at schools, we really don't think that learning to interpret the text has anything to do with our faith, with our religious faith, of with whether we are Jews or Christians. And perhaps I'll just say one word about that, which is I also argue in those concluding paragraphs that hermeneutics of suspicion, which is a broader phenomenon, right? I mean, you think of someone like Paul Ricoeur or Freud, people who approach reality trying to unearth, trying to expose new ideas of reality, basically trying to dispel kind of common sense ideas of reality. This hermeneutics of suspicion, I argue at the end, is also a product, in fact, of the religious history of hermeneutics. So it's really hard to get away from it.
Hmm. Well, as a literary teacher, I think that's wonderful. I feel like, too, that when we all read the same thing, it's almost like having shared experiences as well. So it sort of brings a sense of community on that primary level, in addition to the secondary level of interpreting what we might take that to mean.
Yeah, but you see, I mean, my use of the word community here is somewhat critical, because I think that when we came up with a community of readers, we lost other forms of communities, namely religious communities, traditional communities, where you are part of a singular people, for that matter. And so I think we gained this universal community of readers, but at the cost of losing, I wouldn't say losing, but it's at the cost of other communities that are not present in the same way that they were before.
Do you see that as being a result of these communities, that imagined communities, in a sense, that have sprouted up around around something common like literature? Like, do you see those as being directly related, or just that they're happening at the same time?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that modernity occurred. I mean, right. I think that, yeah, I mean, I first of all, I'm glad you phrase it in this way, because my book is not about like right or wrong. Like, I don't have an alternative, like a better.
Right.
Yeah. I describe a process that I take to be at the core of modernity. And I think that, you know, religious communities, of course, still exist, right? Like, we still go to synagogues and churches, and we still perpetuate traditions that existed for thousands of years. But at the same time, we have this new idea of Menschengeschlecht, you know, of humankind. I mean, I bring one example to kind of elucidate that, because it's quite abstract, and which is the way children learn to read. In traditional Jewish schools, where they still take 5-year-old boys, like they have for thousands of years, and they serve the boys a sheet of paper that is covered with honey, or namely, you have on that sheet the Hebrew letters, the Hebrew alphabet, and it's smeared with honey. And then the boys lick the honey. And that's their first encounter with script, with the alphabet. And then on the same day, they receive their personal copy of the Hebrew Bible. Now, this for me really embodies my argument in the book, or this kind of the phenomena that that I'm describing, which is that when we are a part of a traditional religious community, this affiliation changes the way, or not changes, it forms the way that we relate to texts, that we learn to read and write. And I write, after I describe this this ceremony, that on the one hand, you know, this we still do that, right? Like it's still happening. But at the same time, that sweetness of encountering script is no longer merely by means of being Jewish, let's say, by means of being the chosen people, but all of a sudden, there are new ideas about Bildung, let's say, about education. The fact that when I go to school, when I go to university, and I learn how to interpret a poem, I take part in this human, in this universal human community.
I'm really glad that you brought up that story, because you begin your final chapter with that image of the young boys being first introduced to language through this. I just think it's magical, this idea that you would try to imbue young children with this same sense of reverence for the written word, which is almost a magical thing. I just think that's such a lovely image and such a lovely idea. So thanks very much for sharing that story with us again here. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. I fear I've taken up a lot of your time, but it's been really wonderful to be able to talk about your book.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Before we go, though, can you tell us what you're currently working on?
Yes, on something completely different.
Okay.
I'm working on the idea that one day there will be a huge return of Jews to Europe, like a mass return of Jews and to the continent. And I'm looking at immigrants, at authors writing in German abroad, and also at people who came back to Germany after 1945. And I'm interested in visualizations of Europe as a homeland for Jews, and more specifically, images of return to Europe as a return to the Jewish homeland. And I'm very occupied with how those presentations emulate the vocabulary of early Zionism, of kind of coming back, going back to a Jewish homeland. And of course, I show the set of paradoxes and irony that that incur, let's say, when in those writings and in those works of art.
All right. Well, that sounds really good. I want to thank you again for being on the show today, Yael. I really enjoyed your book. I was so glad to have a chance to talk with you about it in person. I want to wish you a happy rest of the weekend.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
I want to thank you for listening to New Books in Secularism, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Once again, I'm Carrie Lynn Evans, and I've been speaking with Professor Yael Almog about her new book, Secularism and Hermeneutics. If you enjoyed this podcast, please write us a positive review on iTunes, post about us on social media, or tell a friend. The New Books Network is a not-for-profit organization, so all the buzz you can help us generate goes a long way to supporting this work. I'm also interested in hearing from you about your thoughts on this podcast and the material we cover. You can find me on Twitter at Carrie Lynnland. That's at CarrieLynnland. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Do you have a book you'd like covered on one of our shows? Contact us through our website, newbooksnetwork.com. Also, be sure to like the New Books in Secularism channel on Facebook and Twitter, where you'll see every time we post a new interview. In the meantime, I'll wish you à la prochaine until my next conversation about new books in secularism.